In this hour, we're doing the program we call Talk to the Family Doctor, which is something we do every other month with our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He is a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana. And we built these into the schedule to give you a regular opportunity to ask general kinds of healthcare questions. He sees people of all ages in his practice, children, grown-ups, with a variety of health complaints. So it's an opportunity for you to call in and ask questions. Whenever we have doctors on the show, I always try to remind people that there are limits to what we can do because the doctor can't see you. But I don't want to discourage anyone from calling. If you have questions, this might be a good place to start, and then you can take your concerns. Obviously, from that point, you would probably have to go and speak with your own physician or someone who can see you. But this is a place to start by asking basic questions. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have that toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call, use that, and that is 800-222-9455. Whichever one works for you, you can give us a call, and I know that the doctor will do his best to give you an answer. Well, glad to have you here once again.
Thank you, David. I'm glad to be back.
Something that I thought it might be worth mentioning, I came across this as I was looking for things for us to talk about, is we'll talk about tetanus. And the reason that I wanted to raise it, and it seemed to be a seasonal kind of concern, because according to this story, and I got this from the WebMD website, a new survey finds that 57% of adults don't know that the tetanus bacteria is commonly found in the soil, and that despite the fact that about a third of tetanus infection occurs while gardening.
Well, when you mentioned that your speaker coming up later this week was going to be a gardening one, I was thinking about this as we were talking before the show started. And in fact, the organism does naturally exist in the soil. And if you then develop a wound or break in the skin that allows soil or other contaminated material to get into the wound, then you are indeed at risk for tetanus. It's unusual these days to see somebody with full-blown tetanus because it's a routine childhood immunization. But it, like a number of other immunizations, has a finite length of efficacy. And in adults, a tetanus booster is recommended to be given approximately every 10 years to keep your immunity up to date.
Right. So that that is one of the – once you get into the – adult age range, that's one of the shots that you need to
It's actually
continue to
one
about.
Of the few shots that adults routinely get. You get your basic childhood immunizations through school, typically. The last time it's required is the ninth grade physical. So kids get a tetanus booster when they're approximately 14 years old, and then they're probably due for another one in their mid-20s, and then every 10 years thereafter. But during that time frame up to the age of 65, there really aren't any other routine immunizations unless you avail yourself of the opportunity to get a flu shot every year in the fall, which is not an unreasonable thing for anybody who doesn't want to get the flu. But there really aren't any other routine adult immunizations. For individuals who are traveling overseas, depending on where they're going, there may indeed be recommendations for specific types of immunizations against diseases that are not common here. But otherwise, routinely, immunizations would be given again at the age of 65, where a pneumonia vaccination would be recommended for everybody 65 and up. And then certainly at that point, for sure, an annual flu shot is definitely recommended.
All right. We have a couple callers here. We will go on to them. First is in Philo, and line one. Hello. Is there a caller there? Line one?
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, hi. There's been a lot of information on the news lately about an effort to make Champaign and Urbana restaurants and bars smoke-free. And I just wonder if you as a physician could comment on what you perceive the health risks and benefits, well, the health risks of secondhand smoke in particular, whether we're exposed to it in bars and restaurants or other places, and then the benefits of having smoke-free environments would be to the health of those of us who live and eat and work and play in Champaign and Urbana.
Well, personally, as a non-smoker, I would applaud any efforts to make more public places smoke-free. When you talk about risk and benefits, there really aren't any benefits to being exposed to smoke either directly or secondhand. The number of medical organizations and public health agencies that have come out against smoking are endless. I don't think anybody other than the tobacco companies are going to come out for promoting additional smoking in public places. The risks associated with secondhand smoke exposure are the same as those who smoke. It's simply the matter of degree of exposure. We certainly know in the pediatric population that children who grow up in smoking households have a significantly higher risk for respiratory illnesses, ear infections, and they basically consume more health resources than children who grow up in non-smoking households. In workplaces and in public places, the exposure to secondhand smoke simply in terms of how much of a problem it is dependent on the degree of exposure. But I'm not aware that there's any, lower limit that's considered, okay. So keeping it to the minimum would be preferable. And since there isn't any benefit to be gained by exposing others to smoking, I personally would be quite in favor of increasing the number of places where smoking was not allowed.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Well, we'll go on here. Next is line two, and the caller is in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. I have a question about an advertisement I've seen on television recently, and it's for arthritis, and one of the side effects is that you may get TB. Now, what is it in the medication that would give you TB, and why would anybody take something for arthritis that would give you TB, which is, seems to be worse than the problem itself?
You're going to have to give me a little help here. You're going to have to tell me what medication we're talking about.
I don't remember the medication, but it's been on several times. And actually, I can't even remember the...
Well, let me make sort of a general comment.
Right.
I won't be able to necessarily address your specific concern because I don't know the specific medication you're referring to. But there are some new arthritis medications, and by arthritis we usually mean rheumatoid arthritis, the sort of severe crippling arthritis, not the, I wake up in the morning, my hands are a little sore, and I take an Advil, and I feel better kind of arthritis. The type of arthritis that we're talking about here is usually very severe, potentially crippling, and is often treated with what are referred to as disease-modifying drugs, not simple analgesics, not simple anti-inflammatories, but medications that can have, in some instances, a profound effect on your immune system. And it's probably here that they're referring to the potential, if your immunity is down, to acquire illnesses that you normally wouldn't necessarily pick up, such as TB.
Okay. I thank you very kindly.
Okay.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things that I guess people need to understand when they're taking a prescription medication and they're concerned about side effects is that the manufacturers are required to report, and you can go and you can read it if you want to read the physician's desk reference, or there are other books that list prescription drugs, or there's a package insert. There's a piece of paper that comes in the package. When during the time that they were testing the medication, anything anybody reported in that was thought to be a side effect of the medication, anything has to be listed there, even if it's not terribly likely. That is, could be 1,000 people took the medicine and two of them reported a particular kind of symptom.
Right.
That's got to be reported there. I guess I wonder, as if people are taking prescription medication and they're feeling that something maybe isn't quite right and they're suspecting that what it is they're feeling is a result of the medication, I guess I wonder how it is you suggest to people evaluate those, because it's also possible that it could have nothing at all to do with the medication.
That's exactly right. You're correct about the reporting requirements for new medications. Any and all potential side effects related to the medication need to be reported, and then they are listed as potential problems associated with the medication when, in fact, they may not be related whatsoever. It may be coincidental. They may not be causally related at all. And probably the best way to look at that is when they are doing studies with a particular medication, they also usually compare it to a placebo. And the interesting thing is, you know, a placebo is basically just, quote, the sugar pill. It shouldn't do anything. But yet you'll see side effects reported by patients for their placebo. And you say, well, where did that come from? And the answer is, well, we don't know. But what you're really looking for is the difference for a particular side effect between the medication and the placebo. You know, 3% of the people reported a particular side effect with the placebo and 3% reported with the medication, then maybe there's nothing between that particular side effect and the medication at all. On the other hand, if the placebo reports, you know, a 1% incidence and the medication under study reports a 20% incidence, well, then there may be something related to that medication that causes that particular side effect. But I think it's always very, very reasonable for patients to seriously think about that the medications that they're hoping to gain an effect from also then can produce side effects. No medication that produces an effect is without potential side effects. We frequently get asked, well, you know, give me the one that doesn't have a side effect. Well, there aren't any. Even the placebo has, quote, side effects. So people really need to seriously question whether their symptoms really require a medication, because when they take the medication gaining the benefits, they're also assuming the risk that goes along with any potential side effects. And they're quite literally sometimes when it's really not worth it to treat it.
Hmm. Okay. Let's talk next with someone in southeastern Illinois on our toll-free line. This is line 4. Hello.
Comments on everything you've had so far. In the first place, cut down on the number of places, eating places where there's smoking, but would you be in favor of banning it entirely, every eating place, every bar room? I wouldn't. I think people ought to have the ability to eat a Big Mac at McDonald's and get fat if they want to. Smoke, and smoking does have a benefit. I've never smoked. I've never taken a puff of cigarette in my life. But my mother smoked, and she led a pretty hard life, and it's amazing how much I don't know exactly how to say it, but I mean of a relaxing a cigarette, how much a cigarette would do for her. But anyway, another thing on the side effects of drugs. I don't know whether every pharmacist does it, but where I usually get a prescription filled, they stick a slip of paper in there that the pharmacist supplies that gives those instructions on how to use it and what to avoid and all that sort of thing. On the arthritis drug. I was calling in when you said that, and I think I didn't get exactly, but I think you mentioned that it affected the immune system. I think you were right on that, because part of that advertisement tells you not to start the drug if you have an infection. So that would seem to indicate immune system, wouldn't it?
That's correct.
Yeah. I'm not going to ask you for a political statement on this, but everybody everywhere is beating up on the drug companies these days. I mean, I know there's a place where gratitude has to end, but these days I don't see any place where gratitude begins to the drug companies. I mean, I have either a very slowly growing prostate cancer or benign enlargement, and I'm subject to urinary tract infections. And I've long ago left the $15 a course antibiotics. I'm into the $100 a course antibiotics. Now, the last infection took a course and a half to get finished. There'd be an awful lot of us that would be dead if it weren't for the drug companies. And, But I do have some questions, a couple of questions, a couple of candidates for the Bacon Senator's office for nomination to that appeared on this program, and a couple of them beat up on the drug companies. And one of the points that they made was how high the drug companies, how expensive everything is. Well, actually, the drug companies, drugs have cut the cost of treating things. I mean, many things that at one time would have required hospitalization, now you get a prescription and you can take the pills at home and you don't need to pay the tremendous price of hospitalization. Drugs have lowered the per unit cost of treating people. It's just that the number of units of people being treated have so multiplied and so many things are treatable now that weren't treatable in the past, that's where the expense is. But I have two questions, and I don't mean to go on forever. An appearance on one of these candidates, somebody called in from Chicago, I believe it was. Anyway, wherever it was, called in to say that this man had gone to the pharmacist to have a prescription filled, and the pharmacist said, you know, there's a generic drug for that. And he had filled the prescription with a generic drug, and the man had saved a lot of money. Am I correct in my understanding that any time that a patient gets a prescription filled, that he can ask the pharmacist if there is a generic drug for that particular prescription, and if there is, to please fill it with a generic drug, and the pharmacist is free to do that unless the doctor has specifically written on the prescription, do not substitute generic?
That is correct. In the state of Illinois, and this does vary from state to state, but in the state of Illinois, if a prescription is marked may substitute by the physician, then the patient and or the pharmacist may decide to not take the brand name drug but use a generic substitute. Due to FDA regulations, a generic substitute should be biologically equivalent to the brand name medication, and there really shouldn't be any loss of efficacy in taking that particular form of the medication.
Well, now, does the physician have to write may substitute, or can they substitute if he simply doesn't write don't substitute?
If it is simply written with no specific indication that it may not be substituted, yes, it's at the patient's and pharmacist's discretion to take the generic equivalent.
I have another question. One other question. Some of the drug companies, GlaxoSmithKline, for example, has a discount card that, as I understand it, it takes 40% off the cost of drugs. Now, there is a means test, and it's available only for incomes under $40,000, so it's a pretty high means test. And then Pfizer has a program that they advertise where senior citizens, I think, can get a month supply of a drug for $15. Now, whether there's a financial means test on that, I don't know, and I don't know whether these programs are limited to certain drugs or how that goes. But
those programs are limited to the drugs made by that particular manufacturer.
But all of the drugs made by that particular manufacturer, or just some of the drugs made by that particular manufacturer?
It varies by the manufacturer as to what they include on their list. Some will include any medications that they manufacture. Some only have a limited number of medications that they'll cover.
Now, how does the person get that, by applying online somewhere or through their physician, or how do they go about getting such a card?
That's usually something done directly with the manufacturer.
I see. So they'd have to know how to contact the manufacturer.
Correct.
Okay. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
I've gotten a little bit of spleen off because I'm sure the drug companies have their sins, but they've saved an awful lot of us from death. So I think they deserve some gratitude.
All right.
Thank you.
We're about midway through this part of Focus 580, and our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana. Every other month, he's here on the program that we call Talk to the Family Doctor. The idea is that whatever's on your mind that has to do with health care, if you have a question about your health, could be somebody in your family, somebody close to you, could be kids, could be whatever, you can give us a call, and I know the doctor will do his best to give you a comment.
I wanted to go back to one of his original comments, which he basically said, people should have the right to go to McDonald's and eat and get fat. I don't necessarily agree with people eating and getting fat, because if not second and soon to be first, obesity will be the number one preventable medical problem in the United States. But right now, tobacco-related illnesses is probably still number one in terms of preventable disease. But my point about public smoking is that if somebody's sitting next to me eating and getting fat, they're not making me fat. Okay? But if they're sitting next to me and smoking, I am indeed inhaling their smoke. And that is a direct threat to my health at that point. So I think that the differences there need to be pointed out is that when somebody's eating, they're hurting themselves, but they're not at that moment directly hurting anybody else.
Okay. Let's go to another caller, and the next person is in Chicago. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. I want to provide a little bit of dialectic on the tobacco question further also. I would say I have a medical degree, and I've looked into these studies a bit, and incidentally, I'm not in any way affiliated with any tobacco company or directly or otherwise. The studies on the pathogenic effects of smoking tobacco are probably the worst studies that have had the most political effect in human history so far. They are just, which is of course what you expect when a lot of money is thrown by politicians at a particular question in science. They make no attempt to distinguish between brands. They have no success in actually proving that tobacco itself is at the heart of the problem, not denying there is a problem. And the studies of secondhand effects are even worse. I'm not aware that there's one that's worth reading. And it's been suggested by various people that there are ulterior motives involved with this whole demonization of the tobacco industry. Would you like to say anything about that? I could go on also, but
I guess I don't really. Think I want to give you the time to go on to the length that I think you would, but I don't, and I don't really.
Well, that's forthright.
Let Jeff go ahead and
look at the studies, one of the simplest.
You did ask for a response from the doctor, so maybe we should give him a chance to do that.
Okay, when you make sort of a blanket comment about the studies, it's very hard for me to respond to a particular study, and obviously I don't have any particular study in front of me at the moment to refer to, but I do think that there is a wealth of information available that indicates that continued exposure to tobacco smoke is not particularly healthy, whether that's directly or from a secondhand source. And you can debate whether it's the tobacco or something in the filler or something in the filter, that may well be. Nevertheless, the totality of smoking is indeed associated with increased health risk. I've just unfortunately had the very sad experience of having two of my patients in the last few months come down with lung cancers associated with their continued smoking. And over the course of my career, I can't tell you anybody that I've seen with lung cancer who wasn't a smoker. Is that a causal factor? Is it simply a coincidence? I don't know. But I can tell you that it's strongly enough associated with it, and there aren't any other health benefits from smoking, other than the last gentleman's comment about his mother was a little bit more relaxed when she smoked. And I think there are other ways that you can obtain that state other than smoking. So I don't think there's really any benefit to anybody from a medical standpoint when they continue to smoke. And I certainly don't think that there's any benefit to individuals sitting next to a smoker and inhaling tobacco smoke. On an individual basis, if you want to bring a particular study, I'd be happy to look at it. We can critique the way in which it was done and the results and the conclusions that were drawn. But going all the way back to the Surgeon General's report of the early 60s, that's 40 years ago, there's been more and more information obtained that basically says smoking, for whatever reason, isn't good for you.
May I respond, David?
Sure.
I would, obviously no one can do this subject justice in a few minutes, but just two quick points in response to that. It's very well demonstrated that there are many what could properly be called medical benefits of smoking tobacco. It has been statistically proven that it negatively correlates with the development of Parkinson's disease, that negatively correlates with the development of Alzheimer's disease, that improves concentration, that improves performance in many varieties of mental undertakings, that it is a mood leveler, and so forth, all of which can be seen as advantageous in a highly stressed society.
Your comment about the negative correlation with certain illnesses is interesting, but those are illnesses that particularly affect the elderly. If the smokers are dying before they get to be elderly, they're not going to develop Alzheimer's, they're not going to develop Parkinson's. And to say that, therefore, smoking helps prevent these diseases, I think is a little specious in terms of an argument.
I'm going to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me. We just can't give any more time to this. Because the purpose of this program really is for people to call in and ask really basic kinds of stuff of a family practice doctor. I don't think we really should take the time to get into an extended conversation on this subject. Maybe on another day with other guests we can do that, but I think now we need to move on. I do have another caller here who's waiting, and I also want to tell other people who are listening that if you have questions, you can give us a call. This is this show that we try to do to give you a chance to have a regular contact with a family doctor. So if there's something you're concerned about, something for yourself, someone in your family, you can call us 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Next caller up is in Savoy, line number two.
Hi.
Yes.
My question, I hope will be basic, but it's actually about specific prescription drug, namely lisinopril, HCTZ20. And I was just wondering whether, because I was just recently, or rather my physician put me on a regimen about 3 weeks ago on this, and just was wondering whether...
There should be another number associated with that. It's 20/...
Yeah, 12.5.
20/12.5.
Yeah, okay. But the thing is that recently my physician asked me to just bump me up to another, you know, like a pill and a half as opposed to a pill.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually got a new prescription that I got dropped off to be filled. But the thing is that as far as the indications for side effects, I've noted all the ones that were on there, but one of the things that occurred were flu-like symptoms, and I was wondering whether, like, for instance, fever and the dry cough I could see, but the fever wasn't one of the indications. So I was wondering if that's something that's possibly associated with that or more of a viral thing in nature.
Fever would typically not be a drug side effect, except in rare instances, and those folks are usually quite ill.
Okay, so more than likely there's probably some other infection that occurred coincidentally while taking this medication.
Right.
Okay.
The type of medication that you're on is a combination of what's referred to as an ACE inhibitor and a diuretic.
Okay.
And
yeah,
that's usually a very good combination from the standpoint of the two work very synergistically.
Okay.
And the advantage is that you can usually use lower doses of both medications to minimize side effects and yet get the benefit of lowering your blood pressure.
Is that something? Now, if I continue to have side effects, I mean, past the normal range of time that's expected for these things to occur, would it be a possibility to consider going to, say, atenolol, something I've been on previously?
Yes.
Okay.
And the atenolol can also be added to a diuretic as well, if need be.
Thanks a lot, Doctor.
All right, thank you. Off to another caller here. This is Ashmore, line number one. Hello.
Yes, hello. How are you?
Good.
I have a question about the drugs that are possibly in the preventive area for Alzheimer's disease.
A lot of things being looked at. Nothing that I'm personally aware of that has been definitively been shown to be beneficial. So at this point, I'm not aware of any one thing that you can do on a consistent basis now that will definitely prevent you from developing Alzheimer's in the future.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks. I think just recently there was an article, I want to say maybe it was New York Times, talking about the fact that there are a certain number of medications that are now being fairly heavily prescribed for people with Alzheimer's disease, and yet at the same time they were saying, we have to be honest and straight about it, though, is we're really not sure that these things are, that there's much in the way of benefits, but we're using them anyway.
There are some medications that are available now that are FDA approved for use in mild to moderate Alzheimer's dementia that are thought to be helpful in maintaining some of the memory cognitive function. They haven't been overwhelmingly successful, at least in my opinion, but they're the only thing available. So for many individuals and especially their families, you know, as they become concerned about their own memory and cognitive decline, many people are willing to try and take a medication, assuming that they can tolerate it and that there aren't any really bad side effects, to see if it does help. But this is an area where it's very difficult to measure because dementia is such an individual disease, to do large-scale population studies to measure whether drugs are having a significant effect is quite a difficult area to study.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the things I was thinking about, and also the difficulty of diagnosis. I guess it's my understanding still that the only way to make a definitive diagnosis that a person has had Alzheimer's disease is after the person has died. Post-mortem, by looking at the brain. How then do you decide whether the person is still around, that they actually do indeed have Alzheimer's?
Well, that's an excellent question, because there are many other forms of dementia. There are a number of other medical conditions that can indeed cause an individual to lose memory, to suffer a cognitive decline. And when you take all of the people who, quote, become demented, and you look at how many of them have an underlying treatable medical illness that if you fix, they might get better, it's really 10-15%. The other 80-85% have some type of medical process that there really isn't any intervention that we have right now that's going to make any difference. Many of those fall into the Alzheimer's type of dementia, but there are also folks who have small blood vessel disease secondary to their diabetes. There are folks who've had so many little strokes because of their uncontrolled hypertension that they've actually damaged their brain function. So there are some other medical situations where, as part of the end stage process, dementia is part of it, and that's not Alzheimer's. That's an end stage of certain other medical conditions, and medications for that are not going to make any difference. Mm.
Let's go next to Urbana, line number 3. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Well, you've been talking about exactly what I wanted to ask about. My mother's 81 years old, and she's having some problem with basically short-term memory. She seems to do well in remembering her childhood and her wedding and things like that, but things like the day before she'll forget. And you kind of did explain some things for me about dementia and Alzheimer's, and I was kind of wondering if there is a difference, what would that be? Is short-term memory kind of an indicator of Alzheimer's, or is it?
It certainly can be. And in this particular situation, when somebody who otherwise has been functional starts to show this type of decline, it's very reasonable to do the initial medical evaluation to look for some of the underlying potentially treatable causes for this type of decline. There are folks who are depressed, and an antidepressant medication and counseling makes them better. It improves their memory, mm-hmm. improves their concentration. There are folks who are hypothyroid. Their thyroid is just, you know, under functioning, and they become slow, sluggish, poor mentation, and you replace their thyroid, and they're back to their usual self. There are a few other medical diseases that, if found and fixed, can definitely make a difference. So for folks in this situation the first time around, I think it's quite reasonable to have a basic medical evaluation looking for underlying treatable conditions. If you don't find any, then you're pretty much stuck with this is just the way it is. Is it going to get worse quickly or slowly? Well, there's no real good way to predict that. In situations where there's additional questions about really what's going on, formal neuropsychological testing, you know, basic IQ tests and tests of spatial perception, language use, there are a number of things that can help pinpoint what area of the brain in particular seems to be not functioning well. The real question then becomes, well, what can we do about that? And in some instances, the answer is really not much.
Okay. Just to kind of follow up a little bit, I don't live in the same town as my mother, but I have siblings who do, and they're the ones who've been filling me in on some of these things. But I was wondering how appropriate it is to approach my mother's doctor and bring this to his attention, because I don't know if a doctor would really be able to tell unless he or she starts prying and asking questions. But I mean, you know, we're the ones who are around her, and we can see whether, you know, what she remembers, what she doesn't. So
that's exactly right, and it's very appropriate for family members to give that information to her physician, because you're quite correct. The physician may not be aware of that.
Okay. All right. Well, I appreciate your answers. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. We'll go on here. The next caller is, let me see, line number 1 in Urbana. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. My own experience in dealing with several family members, elders with cognitive decline is the doctors that we've dealt with have said that things like Aricept are more likely to be of some help, not cures, but to slow the decline if they're tried early. And even though you can't necessarily diagnose Alzheimer's, if it's a chance, a good chance that it might be that you can try something like Aricept and see if it makes any difference. And for one relative, it helped with speech, sleep, and spatial orientation, so that the person didn't get lost as easily.
Mm-hmm.
And even though the memory isn't better in many respects, life is somewhat better.
Right. In terms of the activities of daily living, if they can be functionally improved, that is definitely a benefit. And you're correct. You may not have a pinpoint diagnosis of exactly what type of dementia, but it's important to have excluded the underlying treatable, reversible causes before simply saying, well, you know, that's the way it is. But once those studies have been done and you're basically dealing with an irreversible situation, then a trial of medication early on is not an unreasonable thing to do, but people need to realize that it's certainly not a cure, and it won't necessarily at all prevent the ultimate decline that's associated with many of these dementing illnesses.
Yeah, you make very, very good points. And I think that it's often hard for people to help an elderly person accept help and to get to the point of getting the person evaluated. And I think the approach that there might be something that's treatable can help, and we need to go and get evaluated, that can be a way to get started.
Yes, very much so.
Thanks.
All right, thank you. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carle Clinic in Urbana. Every other month he's here for the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. Now, if you have questions about your health or maybe someone in your family, you can call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And next we'll talk with someone in Atlanta, Illinois, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm also calling about an Alzheimer's patient. We've been caregivers for my husband's mother for the last 5 years for Alzheimer's. And in January, they approved a new medication called Namenda, and it's for advanced Alzheimer's. And we put her on that, and she's improving.
I'm glad to hear that.
She actually is more aware, and she talks more, and we're really excited about it.
It's a medication that I'm personally not familiar with.
It was approved in Europe for several years before here.
And that's often the case with many new medications that come to the United States. The Food and Drug Administration is fairly strict about which drugs are allowed in the United States, and it's not at all uncommon for medications to have been used overseas in Europe for a number of years, actually before being allowed to be sold in the United States.
So we went to her doctor, and he was excited about it. So we did put her on it, and she's. I don't think there'll ever be a cure. I mean, a total, you know, cure for her, but it has helped her memory tremendously.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that.
I just wanted you to know that we did try it, and it is working. If anyone's interested.
Well, thank you.
All thank right. you.
Well,
thank you for the call.
Mm-hmm.
We certainly have time for other questions. Again, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One quick thing. Way back in the beginning, we were talking a little bit about prescription medicine, and I guess something I feel like it probably would be good to remind people of is that now that we have a lot of people who are interested in and using over-the-counter supplements, there is the possibility that if you're doing that, if you're prescribing something for yourself and you're also taking a prescription medication that a doctor has prescribed for you, there are certain possibilities where there are potential problems of interaction of prescription medication and over-the-counter supplements. So it's good to tell somebody, whether you tell your doctor, maybe you don't want to tell your doctor. Okay, tell your pharmacist then. Tell somebody about other things that you may be taking, because there's always the potential that you could have a problem.
Right. That's very true. And in many instances, the standard question, are you taking any medications, is answered no, but when you say, well, but are you taking any herbs? Are you taking any supplements? Are you doing anything special with your diet? You know, oh, well, you know, I do this, 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 and these other things. In some instances, it's not a problem. In other instances, as you point out, there are some potential interactions. And in some instances, we just flat out don't know. The whole issue of herbs and supplements, because they're not subject to FDA approval, basically means they're out on the market. They can almost claim whatever they want, though they always, if you read the small print, basically say, you know, we're not promising you anything in terms of your health. But they imply in their advertising that it's good for this, that, or the other thing. But there really aren't any scientific large-scale studies for the vast majority of things that are out there. There are a few things that actually are beneficial and helpful and probably worthwhile, but that's probably the small minority of things that are actually on the market right now.
Okay. Urbana, another caller here, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Excellent. Glad you started talking about supplements. That's why I'm calling. I've been told that I should take calcium, and I went to the store and became totally confused by the huge variety of calcium supplements. And then I tried to read up about stuff and found that, and it also makes a difference what else you take at the same time or what you're eating in the time of day. Can you give me a straightforward answer as to what I should actually take?
You're exactly right. There are a wide variety of different brands of calcium. And they're basically different based on the salt that they're combined with. There's calcium gluconate, there's calcium carbonate, and depending on what they're combined with will indeed affect the absorption of the amount of calcium that actually then ends up in your system. If you combine calcium with the phosphorus that's, say, in soda pop, you can increase the risk of kidney stones.
Okay.
It goes sort of on and on. So I'm not sure, based on sort of limited knowledge of your diet and lifestyle, that I can tell you for sure exactly what it is that you should be doing. But this is probably a question best addressed to your personal physician or your pharmacist, who knows your other medications, potentially other medical conditions. The general encouragement for women in particular to make sure that they're getting adequate calcium intake is obviously to help prevent osteoporosis later. But you can also get calcium in your diet if you're willing to get in 3 milk or dairy servings a day. That would be an adequate calcium intake.
Well, it was suggested because I seem to have developed a lactose intolerance with age, so that was the reason behind it.
Mm-hmm.
But from what you're saying, though, I mean, do you think there are concoctions of calcium on the market that just don't work?
It's not that they don't work. There are differences in the degree of absorption, and there are differences in the degree of tolerability. Certain formulations of calcium are irritating to the stomach, and a lot of that is just individual response. So in terms of measuring, you know, am I getting enough calcium? At least when it comes to bone density, the only good way to actually measure that is to do a bone mineral density test. And then after a period of time, check to make sure that it's remaining in the normal range.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye. So does it really, I don't know how well we can go into this, but does the, for example, the kind of calcium carbonate, is that really different in the way that it's absorbed from a different kind of formulation calcium?
It can be in terms of a given individual and what other things are in their diet.
Huh, okay.
Yes.
And another thing that people need to realize is you also got to have vitamin D with your calcium, or that helps in the absorption process, is that right?
Pharmacologically, internally, your body needs vitamin D to process calcium in order to get it into your bones. Most people are not vitamin D deficient. a number of foods, in particular milk, are vitamin D fortified, and simple exposure to sunlight provides usually an adequate amount of vitamin D. So there are very few people who are actually vitamin D deficient.
Okay, because sometimes there are calcium supplements that are packaged that way.
Yes.
It's calcium and the vitamin D.
That's right.
To make sure that you get enough.
Right.
But if you were getting an adequate amount in your diet and you didn't live in a cave, maybe you really didn't. Maybe you really wouldn't need
it.
Okay. Well, that's what makes it. Nutrition is extremely confusing. And on the Afternoon Magazine now, they do a show every month on nutrition. They just did it last week, so it'll be a while before they'll have the opportunity to talk to the nutritionist.
And that's one of the difficult things about making any sort of hard and fast pronouncements about the health benefits of various forms of nutrition is it would take very, very large scale studies, and you have to control everything else to be able to say that this one particular thing is what made the difference.
Okay. We are just about the point we're going to have to finish up. I don't know, is there anything, any last little bit you'd...
Well, I just want to thank the listeners for a very spirited discussion here today. We covered some really good topics.
All right. Well, our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor. He is on the program every other month, so I guess that means we will see you again in July? No, in June.
Your dementia is catching up with you.
Tell me about it. Sometime again, he'll be here on the program. It's always a Monday every other month, and we take your questions on family health. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
Family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana.